countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt-in, opt-in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you A Step Farther Out, your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society.
And it is Saturday the 9th of May in the glorious future year of 2026. And I am live. I have to apologize for having missed doing my show last week. I lost track of time while riding the trams in Blackpool, to be perfectly honest. Now, let me drop a link into Calm, because I did record a show and I tried to upload it to a non-radio, and for whatever reason it did not replace whatever's in the archive currently, which is basically junk. Anyway, but let me drop a link into Calm for the substitute audio file for last week so you can listen to my last week's show. And using the SDF link shortener, that is sdf.org/l/2w5. That's sierradeltafoxtrot.org/lima/2whiskey5. I always have to stop myself from saying walrus. 2 walrus 5. Now, I don't see Kuma in Calm. She was supposed to be back from Warsaw by now, but I haven't heard from her. I hope she's all right. She was complaining of having injured her foot. But I am back in Munich. I am back in Munich. And I should tell you what happened while I was in Blackpool. So, I didn't wind up going to the Manchester Science and History Museum at all. So that's another one I have to add to my list. So the Hopetoun Museum in Darlington, the Manchester Science and Industry Museum, the P.K. Porthcurno Museum, all the way in the west, furthest west of Cornwall. These are museums that I need to go visit. I just do, right? I did, however, while I was in Blackpool, visit the museum in Fleetwood. I should sort of explain what happened. That Sunday, I had thought, okay, well, while I was riding the streetcar around, I saw an advertisement for a car boot sale, which is a thing that they do in Britain. And I thought, well, maybe a car boot sale in this area where you can see the Heysham nuclear power plants. Maybe I can find some memorabilia about it. I may have been misleading myself in this respect, because dropping into charity shops in the area, I didn't find anything of the kind. But there might have been something. Unfortunately, the car boot sale was postponed from Sunday to Monday because of threatening rain. And so then I said, well, that's okay. I'll go and I'll get on the train. It's only noon. I'll get on the train. I'll go to Manchester, and I'll spend a few hours at the Manchester Museum of Science and Industry, and then come back. And I got on the train from Manchester, and as we should have been pulling away, we were just sitting there, and the driver comes on and says, I'm sorry, there's been a police responding to an incident at Chorley, and we will not be able to proceed to Manchester at this time. And so I threw up my hands in disgust, and went back to the, I went back into Blackpool, and I said, well, maybe I can go up the Blackpool Tower. And so I went to the building where the Blackpool Tower is, and I said, is the tower open? And they said, no, I'm sorry, there's been a technical fault. Apparently the elevator had failed, and somebody was stuck up there for 3 hours at the top of the tower, which must have been quite annoying. I'm not sure if there's a restroom up there. Anyway, on Monday, as I say, I rode the streetcar up again to the north end to Fleetwood Ferry, and I went and there was a sign for the local museum. So I went and saw the local history museum, which has an excellent coverage about fishing boats and an excellent coverage about Fisherman's Friend cough drops, which are made in Fleetwood. And nothing whatsoever about the Hesham nuclear power stations, which I was disappointed by. Fleetwood is, however, very, very interesting historically, because it was the first community in Britain, and by implication, first community in the world, to be a planned new town set up as a seaport served by a rail line. That the aristocrat who owned what was just basically enormous sandy spit of land which wasn't good for agriculture, wasn't good for anything else, had been at the opening of the Liverpool and Manchester Railway in 1830, and when he heard that somebody was going to build a railway, the Yorkshire and Lancashire, to Preston in Lancashire, he decided to mortgage all of the property he could and build a rail line between Preston and this sand spit. Because he figured it had a decent anchorage, and he got a railroad expert to estimate for him what it would cost to build the railroad, and it was generally believed at the time, this in the early 1840s, that a railroad could not be built to Glasgow because of the topography. And so they were going to set up a port for a steamer line which would run back and forth between Fleetwood and Glasgow, and it would give you a basically cut off a lot of distance in going from Glasgow to London. It would be much faster to go from Glasgow to Fleetwood by steamer and then Fleetwood to London by rail than it would be to go from Glasgow to Edinburgh and then from Edinburgh to London. Well, the railway cost considerably more than was initially expected. And the seaport had only been open for about a year when a railroad engineer with some fascinating new ideas succeeded in running a line to Glasgow, thus making the steamer link between Fleetwood and Glasgow of considerably less importance than it had been. In the year that it was, you know, the thing, it was actually used by Queen Victoria and her retinue. So it was, you know, not a bad thing altogether. One of the amusing things is that right on the headland, this aristocrat built what he called the North Euston Hotel, and he brought all the staff from Euston Station in London. And of course, if you're going from Fleetwood, or, well, there's no railway service to Fleetwood anymore. You have to go to Blackpool and take the tram. But if you take the tram from the North Euston Hotel to Blackpool North Station, and then a train from Blackpool North Station to Preston, Lancashire, and you change for the direct train to London, where do you go to? Euston. That's Euston, by the way, for those of you who are not familiar with it. Not to be confused with Houston, Texas. Very different things. But the Fleetwood, as it turns out, became something of a model for local government in Britain. As a planned new town that was created from the ground up, they had to come up with ways of doing things that had been managed more or less by tradition in other parts of Britain. And so they actually had to think about them and try things and see whether they worked or not. And as a result, it became kind of a laboratory in miniature for the redesigning of local government under a whole series of reform acts which have continued on down to the present day. Anyway, although it failed as being a seaport for going back and forth to Glasgow, for some time it was a very successful seaport for going back and forth to Isle of Man. For a long time it was an important fishing port. For a while, it was a big port for container freight and roll-on, roll-off going between Britain and Northern Ireland. As with so many things in Britain, a lot of the things that they did there wound up sort of winding down because there was infrastructure that needed improvements and nobody's willing to put up the money to do it, even though they were making money hand over fist in some cases, using the infrastructure, the port and so on, they weren't willing to sink the money in to keep it up and improve it. Anyway, currently the old port and the coal yard, the old port has been redeveloped into a marina and yachting basin, and the what were the coal yards, which brought huge amounts of coal to be loaded into the bunkers of fishing trawlers, has been redeveloped for, with outlet malls and that kind of thing. It's pretty interesting. Anyway, so it's they've got a nice little local history museum. But I never did get to that car boot sale. I'm thinking I've got to go back sometime and actually take the Fleetwood Ferry and take the ferry across to the other side and see what's there, and maybe they know a little bit, maybe they have a little bit more to say about Hesham Power Plant. Dunno. It's worth finding out. And anyway, it's really quite interesting. The again, the Blackpool tram system is the only one in Britain that wasn't torn out between the 1950s and 1970s. I was deeply amused because many of the trams had a banner on the front saying, according to the National Association of Public Transport Operators or whatever, you know, Britain's number one transport tram operator in 2025. And I thought, well, for many years, that would have been an uncontested title. I also bumped into, on the tram on Sunday, a member of the Fylde Coast Friends of the Fylde Coast Tramway Society, who apparently were having their annual general meeting there in Blackpool while I was there, and I didn't know anything about it, because I would have dropped in on them and maybe joined their organization if I had. Unfortunately, the tram museum there, 2 days before I arrived, had been closed down because it failed a structural inspection. That's never good. Apparently, the building is unfit. Anyway, again, never glad to see that happen. And I was talking with the fellow from the Fylde Tramways Society, and he said, it's basically lack of support is the big problem. So I don't know what to do about that. Other than that, so something happened a couple of weeks ago that got a lot of people really excited, and my point of view was, this is not actually as big of a deal as you think. Well, firstly, people in Britain were crowing that, wind power has produced 50% of Britain's electricity needs, around 3 a.m. on a weekend. So, your wind output has, after being, and the graphs are interesting because they show there's days after days of basically nothing, and then suddenly it rises, and the thing is, the output rises, and in the middle of the night on a weekend during a period of extremely low power demand, that accounts for more than 50% of the country's power demand. Yippee! I'm not really all that impressed. But worse than that is people crowing over electricity prices briefly being driven negative in the Baltic power pool area. Now, I should try to explain what this means and how it happens. Because, of course, your first thought is, nobody's going to generate electricity if they have to pay other people to take it. So negative electricity prices are not actually a good thing. And of course, you're talking wholesale electricity prices, which are very much different from what the consumer pays, right? But it's bigger than that, because essentially what happens is, in Denmark, most electricity is not generated by wind. Most of their electricity is generated by thermal power plants. Now, these thermal power plants, many of them burn trash, some of which is imported from other countries, and they have fancy accounting which claims that this is carbon neutral, which again is one reason that I don't buy into a lot of the claims people talk about, carbon credits, carbon offsets, this kind of thing, and a lot of the accounting for this is very shady. Anyhow, But the thing is that the generation from those thermal plants is not sold on the spot market. It's subject to long-term contracts. So where the wind generation, on the other hand, is in the spot market. Generally what happens, the wind comes up and the Norwegians will cut back their hydro generation and bank water in their hydro reservoirs. And what this essentially means is that the Danes pay the Norwegians a hefty amount of money to store electricity for them, essentially, right? Because the price is very low, the Norwegians cut back their generation and use wind electricity. When the price goes high and the wind electricity is nowhere to be found, the Norwegians open the valves and sell again, right? So the Danes are basically paying the Norwegians to take their wind power. It's a bit of an odd phenomenon. But if it so happens that you're in a time of year when there's lots and lots of meltwater coming down from the Norwegian mountains, so that they can't close the valves on the hydro stations, then you've got a bunch of power that has no matching demand, because again, you're in the middle of the night, and yeah, spot market prices for electricity will go negative. Doesn't mean, again, that overall people are paying less than zero for electricity. Doesn't mean that generators overall are paying people to take electricity. It's a brief, momentary phenomenon in the spot market, which is only a fraction of the power that is actually being generated and used. But again, it's not really something to celebrate, because the main thing it demonstrates is that you have power generation which is totally unmatched with demand. Now, in this context, then, we have brilliant news recently of a bunch of British investment bankers, basically, the people that you can count on to have the best ideas, British investment bankers who want to revive an idea which Hugo Gernsback was talking about in the 1920s, an idea which people were talking about, again, I say, in the 1920s. You can go and you can look, like I say, Gernsback published some of this stuff, lots of people published it, various schemes for meeting the needs of the world with renewable energy once the coal ran out in 300 years or so. And these invariably involve huge intercontinental power cables, particularly running around the Arctic Circle, because there's more land around the Arctic Circle, right? And the idea being that, you know, when the sun is high on one side of the world, it's not on the other side of the world, right? The Earth being a spheroidal object, and power is demanded in different places at different times. Power can be generated from solar sources in different places at different times. Power will be generated from wind at different places in different times. There's a lot of fundamentally non-dispatchable power, the generation of which is governed by forces. Tidal power, once again, governed by forces that humanity has little or no control over. And so to make that work efficiently, you've got to run these huge east-west circular interconnectors all around the North Pole, then with branches dropping down thousands and thousands of kilometers into even Central and Southern Africa, India, places like that. Colossal infrastructure projects. Now, this is not an inherently bad idea. It's just that we don't need to do it. Right. What you have to realize is that this colossal infrastructure project is made essentially irrelevant by the availability of nuclear energy. They're talking about a 6-gigawatt link. So the biggest HVDC cable you can run under the sea at the present time is a 2-gigawatt link. And they're talking about a 6-gigawatt link between Canada and Europe. And they say, well, you know, when the Russians invaded Ukraine, and then there was the cutting of the Nord Stream gas pipeline, and, you know, it suddenly became obvious, because nobody had mentioned it before, nobody had even imagined it before, that Europe was just too dependent on Russian energy. You know, as I think we've established before, this was a surprise to nobody. And it was by design that, you know, Gerhard Schroeder went directly from the German Chancellery to a cushy job with Gazprom as a quid pro quo for getting the German Energiewende pushed through to shut down German nuclear power plants in order to make Germany economically dependent on Russian gas. And Germany's economic dependence on Russian gas then effectively neutralized the European Union, because, of course, Germany has a great big influence in the EU, effectively neutralized the European Union from taking steps against Putin when he first invaded Crimea and Ukraine in 2014. Saying that we're going to eliminate the vulnerability of Europe to importing fossil fuels from Russia by connecting it with an electricity link to Canada has a couple of obvious flaws. One is you can at least stock up for a few weeks worth of fossil fuels. Right. If an electricity cable gets cut, bam! Right? That's an instantaneous failure, not a thing where you can cope by running down stocks over a period of weeks. Secondly, it's really expensive. Even assuming everything goes perfectly, it's hard to see how this 6-gigawatt HVDC cable would not cost a great deal more than 6 gigawatts of nuclear generating capacity. And take more time. And I want to be clear on this, because it's not necessarily obvious. They're talking about a bidirectional cable to move off-peak power from Europe to Canada, serve peak demand, and vice versa. And of course, one of the things you have to realize about this is that that cable is going to be idle a lot of the time. When there's not a demand peak on one side and a supply peak on the other, it's not going to be carrying anything. So its actual value is much less than that of a 6-gigawatt nuclear power plant. In all honesty, one or two of the German 1,400 megawatt nuclear plants that were forced shut down would do more to stabilize the European power grid than this whole project. So what's the deal? Well, the article that I found gives some hints. One is that the merchant bankers who are pushing this seem to have also been involved heavily in investing in wind power in Atlantic Canada, and particularly offshore wind in Atlantic Canada. The problem being that Nova Scotia, Newfoundland, Labrador, Prince Edward Island, New Brunswick don't really have any market for large quantities of wind power. And these folks were trying to sell this power for export in the form of green hydrogen, but of course, as I've pointed out any number of times, moving hydrogen by tanker is not a winning proposition. Hydrogen as a fuel in general is kind of questionable, and moving it between continents, even more so. And so they are, I think, trying to salvage their investment by putting a lot more money down the hole. And again, this is a situation we're only in because there are extremists who will not countenance doing the obvious thing, which is to build a few more nuclear power plants. And I have to make clear, I'm going to repeat it, this 6-gigawatt cable is going to be worth a lot less than 3 gigawatts on average. But if you're a merchant banker, and you're accustomed to arbitrage, and you're seeing, ooh, we've got power markets on both sides of the Atlantic where prices fluctuate, and I can buy cheap over here and sell expensive over there. That's what you're focused on. That's what you think looks like a good idea. And it doesn't actually matter whether or not that makes any sense from an overall power systems perspective. The truth is, it's all about a very restricted definition of economics, a kind of economics which makes a lot of sense to bankers and doesn't make a lot of sense to the real world. I'm sorry to say it, but it's true. Now, in other things that don't make a lot of sense, I mentioned before this Canadian Atlantic spaceport, and that I had serious doubts. Firstly, of course, because Canada had a space launch site at one time, Churchill, Manitoba, and there's no effort being made into rehabilitating that, but also that there are, even if I were going to pick an Atlantic site in Canada, Canso, Nova Scotia is not it. Well, I've been reading more about it, and the more I read about it, the more dubious I get, to be perfectly blunt, the more it appears to me that this is really not well thought through and gives very little likelihood of actually leading to any real space launches. You're talking about currently a concrete pad less than 3 kilometers from the nearest house, and less than 10 meters square. And while people like SpaceX, and before them, G. Harry Stein of the DCX, have done a great deal in making launch complexes less complex, which of course is one reason I'm not a big believer in SpaceX's BFR, in other words, that requires a far more complex launch structure, launch infrastructure, launch pad and facilities than what they've been working with previously. A bare concrete pad ain't going to do it. You know, if you're going to fuel with liquid oxygen, for example, with kerosene RP1, you probably need tanks for that. At a very minimum, you need radars, right? You need the Canadian forces to set up satellite tracking stations and set up a launch range. None of that has been done. The Canadian Space Agency is involved to some extent, the Ministry of Transport is involved to some extent, but there's no indication that anybody is either building a permanent launch range or bringing in ships with the necessary radar capabilities. So, yeah, it all looks very much like the Canadian federal government is just giving $200 million away at the rate of $20 million a year. And the likelihood that any space launches will ever result from it is minimal. Anyway, send your cards and letters of comment to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas 76101, United States of America, and I'll read them when I get back in June. If you'd like to encourage me, you can send money to paypal.me/PrometheusLives or a recurring contribution, patreon.com/man_and_atom. And coming up next is the Dubious Goals Committee with Tobe, which is on and on radio every day of the year at 1930 UTC.
Ever. World News.